So I'm delighted to present our next speaker, Jean-Philippe Lessard. At this moment, Jean-Philippe is the current postdoc for the Quebec Center for Biodiversity Science, but he is on the verge of joining the faculty at Concordia University here in Montreal later this fall. JP received his PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from the University of Tennessee in 2010. Subsequently, he went and conducted postdoctoral research at the Center for Macroecology, Evolution and Climate at the University of Copenhagen. His current research interests are focused on the assembly of communities, tree communities in particular, and much of his fieldwork is carried out at McGill's Galt Nature Reserve. So Jean-Philippe, come and join us.
Hi, everybody. Thanks to Andy and Tony for giving me the chance to speak to you today. It's been a great group of speakers, very interesting talks and discussion, and I'm glad to contribute to it or try to contribute to it. And it was a bit difficult for me to decide what to talk about when I got this invitation because I consider most of my work actually tries to ignore the effect of humans on biodiversity because it's much more convenient to do it like that. But then I do realize that humans do play a role in biodiversity and that they will probably reshape how biodiversity looks like in years to come. So I decided to talk about this topic that came up in the literature recently, which is how does phylogenetic diversity might change and whether we should consider this aspect of biodiversity when we try to conserve things.
These guys suggested that we should think about it, and then there were a few response papers to this of other views, maybe not totally agreeing with this. And though I never thought of myself as doing conservation biology, I do work with patterns of phylogenetic diversity, and so I started thinking about whether the patterns I've shown in recent years had any implication for conservation. So basically I'm going to show you some work that I've done in global pattern of phylogenetic diversity, and then I'll speculate a great bunch about whether we should care about patterns of phylogenetic diversity and whether we should care about conserving them or not. And to be honest, I really don't have an answer yet, and so this is just a chance to think about it loudly and maybe get some input from you guys. So when I hear the word global diversity, this is the picture that shows up in my head as this gradient of species richness, in this case of vertebrate. So it's been studied by ecologists for a long time. We know that there's lots of species in the tropics or along the equator and many less species in more northern latitudes. And so that's one aspect of biodiversity. Some more specialized ecologists might call this alpha diversity, which is the number of species one finds in any given place or in a grid cell, for example. But there's another kind of biodiversity that's become more a focus of biodiversity study. It's this idea of composition turnover. So the fact that when one moves to one place to the other, there will be different species, and the degree to which the species will differ might depend on various things. And that idea is actually not new. People like Alfred Wallace, who some of you might know, was already thinking a long time ago about whether a different place on this planet had different species, and even tried to divide the world in a way as to synthesize much of what we knew about how species composition changes from one place to the other. So this is like the first widely recognized map of pattern of species turnover, or another way to put it, this is the first map of the biogeographic regions of the world. And a biogeographic region really is just it's a region where you might expect that if you travel from one place to the other, there'll be minimal turnover, there'll be minimal differences in which species you encounter. Whereas if you cross a biogeographic barrier, such as this one here, into another biogeographic region, you should see all of a sudden a very strong turnover in species composition. And so more recently, there are some ecologists out there that start thinking about can we find a more a more updated way of dividing the world into biogeographic regions. Wallace did it using very minimal amount of information on the distribution of vertebrates, and of course he didn't really use statistics to try and divide the world into biogeographic regions. So Kraft and Yates in 2010 came up with a map for mammals where they divided, they basically divided all the worlds in a bunch of small grid cells of 1 degree by 1 degree latitude, longitude, and then they looked at, they took each grid cell and look at which species was overlapping, which species range was overlapping in a grid cell, and that was the composition of that given grid cell. And then they tried to cluster those grid cells into biogeographic regions, and using multivariate statistics and very complete information on where species are in the world. And that's what it looked like. And they didn't only produce this map, they also suggested an actual, a full framework for how we should go about dividing the world or any kind of assemblages into biogeographic region. And what they suggested is, so you start with this matrix of species by grid cells. So a 1 says that a species occurred in that grid cell, and a 0 would say there's no species. That species does not occur in that grid cell. And you can do that for all the species in the world, and you end up with this humongous grid cell by species matrix. And then you can use a beta diversity metric that basically gives you an estimate of similarity for all pairwise grid cells in the world and tell you just how similar two grid cells, any two grid cells are in terms of their species composition. And then you'll select a clustering algorithm, so a tool that will allow you to decide how to divide these grid cells into biogeographic regions. And there's a way, there are ways to evaluate which is the ideal number of division, the ideal number of clusters. And then finally you can project these clusters on a map to make it more easily to visualize. So I'm not going to go in details. I'm just saying this is a framework that was developed. It's really useful. And so myself and a group of colleagues, we decided to use it to redo this thing with all vertebrates of the world, but including a phylogenetic aspect to it. So when you basically created this pairwise matrix here, instead of just looking at differences in species composition, we look at differences in phylogenetic composition, or in another way, we look at phylogenetic turnover. And so why should you do this? Why should you pay attention to phylogenetic similarities? Well, I like to take this, to give this very simple, maybe simplistic example, where you have three grid cells that you're trying to divide into different clusters. But in this case, you have absolutely no similarity. So the little symbols represent different species, and as you can see, none of these grid cells share a single species. And so it's pretty much impossible to classify these guys. And there are very, when you try to divide the world into biogeographic regions, there are many, many, many cases where two grid cells have zero species in common. And so what phylogeny can do is to provide you a way to classify these grid cells based on the evolutionary history of these species or the share of phylogenetic relatedness. And so take this example here where you have the same species as in this case, but the color indicates how closely related these species are in the phylogenetic tree. And so in this case, you do have different species, but they all come from about the same clades in the tree. And so we'll attribute a turnover that is smaller than in a case where, again, you have a complete turnover of species, but on top of that, you have species that come from very different clades in the phylogeny. And so once you try to summarize global patterns of turnover, this proves useful in terms of in terms of establishing relationships among grid cells and among regions of the world. So that's what we did. We used this global data set that was available. We're combining data on the global distribution of birds, mammals, and amphibians. And we also had some coarse phylogenetic trees that we could use and combine with this data to create these matrices of phylogenetic turnover. And then we did this using the framework of Kraft and Yates, which I briefly mentioned earlier. And this is what came out of it. So a new phylogenetic-based map of the biogeographic regions of the world. And if you compare it to that of Wallace, or other similar maps produced without phylogeny in the last decade or so, the main differences, I mean, there's a lot of similarities, the first thing. And then the main difference are things such as the extension of the Palearctic realm to the northern part of the Nearctic. Also, the Oceanian realm is something that is newly recognized, and things like the Panamian realm were not considered independent biogeographic regions in the past. And so, in a way, this is the current state of biological diversity, or at least the current state in the organization of phylogenetic diversity in the world. And I've been thinking about how this might change in the future. But before I get there, one more thing is that once you've divided the world into biogeographic regions, you can potentially quantify the amount of evolutionary uniqueness in each region. That is, which regions have the most unique phylogenetic assemblages. And so that's what came out of it. So Australia has, if you look at the mean phylogenetic distance between Australia and the rest of the world, it is very high. But if you look at the mean phylogenetic relatedness between North America and the rest of the world, it is fairly low. And so we basically assume that this is a way to quantify evolutionary uniqueness, and we see that the southern parts of the world tend to have more evolutionary uniqueness. Now, how might that change in the future? I took this paper from Jenkins et al., published in PNAS not so long ago, where they show patterns in the diversity of vertebrates, and especially those vertebrates that are threatened and those vertebrates that have very limited distribution. And so this is a way to argue that places that have either a lot of threatened species or a lot of small-ranged species are probably places where we expect a lot of change in years to come. And so the question then becomes, are these places coincident with places where we have high evolutionary uniqueness according to this map here? And what you can see is that there's not a very strong congruence. And so we might lose species in places where there's not too much evolutionary uniqueness, so we might actually be able to preserve evolutionary uniqueness. And then they went on in this paper and discussed which parts of the world should be prioritized for conservation. And again, that was based on the concentration of small range species. And you can see some overlap with our map here in the Andes and the Atlantic forest. But then places where we find differences are, for example, in tropical Africa, where we find quite a high level of evolutionary uniqueness, but this is not designated as a high priority conservation area. Same thing for most of Australia, where we find that Australia is by far the place where we have the most evolutionary uniqueness, and these don't come up as area for the prioritization of conservation. So what this means is if some of us decide to care about preserving parts of the phylogenetic tree that are found in only one place, then we might be missing some of it by only focusing on small range species. So again, what evolutionary uniqueness means in simple words, it's usually driven by places that have entire clades that are found almost nowhere else in the world. So it's a kind of a phylogenetic endemism indication, and these phylogenetic hotspots are not necessarily going to be prioritized according to current approaches for prioritization. And then the last thing I want to show is if we look at places that where we've discovered a lot of new species in recent years, actually, these places coincide better with the evolutionary uniqueness. And so we're basically finding new species in places where there are also evolutionary unique species. And so these might be places that deserve special attention. And so should we prioritize the conservation of phylogenetically unique species, yes or no? I'm still not sure about this. I do know that there are groups of conservation groups that are paying attention to these evolutionary unique species and trying to improve awareness of these guys. But ultimately, I think it is an important philosophical question that we're bound to ask ourselves now, whether we want to start not only looking at where rare species are, but also where evolutionary unique species are, and if we want to protect those or not. And so with that, I'd like to thank all my co-authors on this paper, where we describe the phylogenetic biogeographic regions of the world, and especially to Ben Holt, who was my the co-lead first author on the co-first author on that paper. All right, thank you very much.
In dealing with the question of should we or should we not protect unique species, we ought to consider what is unique about them and what is important to us. For example, are we dealing with special diseases, as an example, or are we dealing with the need for specially preserved living conditions? In other words, what would it take, or what will it take, to keep this uniqueness, and at what cost, both human and otherwise?
Yeah, I agree with you.
What I'm asking is, have these factors been considered at all, is really what I want to know.
Well, I mean, the arguments that I've read about are mostly about preserving functionality, right? So there's a lot of dialogue about whether phylogenetic diversity is also a proxy for functional diversity. And so potentially by preserving evolutionary unique species, we're also preserving unique ecosystem function. Whether that's true or not, or whether it matters or not at that scale is a different question. I haven't read so much about diseases, but that's certainly a valid point of view.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for watching this session.